Thank you, people. We'll get underway. Start of day two. This has got two preliminary issues for us before we deal with them. You may have to raise. The first is that we've conferred and our position is that we're not encouraging or asking for more population estimate evidence. If you want to make an application, of course we'll consider it, but that's our position. And the second is something that I should have asked you yesterday, arising out of Ms. Malsop's, somewhere in the minute I fired in your direction about the implications of the CABC O&L lines. Ms. Malsop maintains her opinion, I'm reading her summary, which of course I expected. I didn't anticipate that the new CATC was doing something different, should alter her professional opinion. What I wanted to do, though, is to ask you, as the council's lawyer, and in the fullness of time, I'll ask Mr. Barr, as the council's planner, whether in terms of the obligation under section 74 to consider the extent to which the plan needs to be consistent with the provisions of neighbouring plans and the policies in the plan about integration with neighbouring plans, which I think is in section 1, whether, notwithstanding the landscape position, there is an issue that we need to confront.
In this instance, I don't think there is, sir. As you have just set out, section 74.2 requires that it's a matter to be considered. It doesn't require that the two district plans be consistent in terms of their frameworks. And also, of course, the lines on the maps. I have discussed this very matter with Ms. Malsop after filing her summary of evidence, and she has again looked at the site and identified that further along from the area which is subject to a subdivision, the ONL line does come back down the hill within the neighbouring district, which gives even further comfort to the council that it is actually taking the appropriate approach in terms of identifying this land as outstanding natural landscape and protecting it as such.
So there are some writing, just make sure I'm writing, the note I'm writing is correct. There are technical reasons for a bulge at that point as well as
that there are technical reasons. It's due to the consents that were issued by the Central Otago District Council prior to plan change. I think it's 5A going through, and that is the plan change which I understand placed those lines on the maps.
Does anyone else have any preliminary questions for Ms. Scott before we get underway with the evidence?
Thank you.
There are just two information requests that related to Dr. Reid's evidence at Glendo. The first was a request for the updated structure plan to be provided with the covenant areas overlaid. We haven't managed to do that overnight. We need the council's GIS people to do that. Mm-hmm. Which will happen, and we will get that information to you as soon as it is available. The second was the panel requested a copy of the covenants that are also relevant at Glendo. Before if I provide these to you, I just want to make sure we're giving you what you need. The covenants are sitting within the third final, what we call the Parkins decision, which is attached to Mr. Ferguson's evidence. There are six pages of covenants. We can simply pull them out and provide them to you, but I'm wondering if you want them in a Word version so you can play around with them or use them in some way, or is it simply just an extracted copy of these covenants that you would like?
What I had in mind was an extracted copy in order that, rather than going into either the position of Mr. Ferguson's evidence, but now that you remind me, I do recollect the whole decision was there, in order that I could look at the plan with the covenants alongside it.
Yes. We're happy to provide that extract. The decision's also on our Facebook as well. We'll get that printed off and provide it to you.
Thank you very much.
I'll now like to call Dr. Reed. She has provided a statement of evidence in chief and one statement in rebuttal. And I will ask her to read out her highlight summary.
My name is Marion Reed. I've been engaged by Queenstown Lakes District Council to provide evidence in relation to landscape matters regarding rezoning requests in the Unicloset area of the Queenstown Lakes District and to related landscape classification issues. My evidence addresses the landscape classification of the Matukituki Valley and of the Fernburn Valley and the location of the ONL-ONF boundary adjacent to the Albertown Bridge. It also addresses rezoning requests in the Makarora Valley and in the Glendu Bay, Parkins Bay areas. Submissions 339, 585 and 706. And I've noted further submission 1106, but I gather that was a generic submission rather than a specific one. Submission 339, 585 and 706 request the uplifting of the rural lifestyle zoning over the Makarora Valley floor and its replacement with rural zoning. Further submission 1106 opposes this relief. Without considering the existing zoning of the valley, I've undertaken a landscape classification assessment from first principles and consider the Makarora Valley to be part of a wider outstanding natural landscape. Approximately 1,292 hectares of the valley floor has been notified rural landscape in the PDP, and of this, approximately 880 hectares could potentially be developed in accordance with the rules of the rural lifestyle zone. This level of development would transform the landscape of the valley, fragmenting the open pastoral areas through the inclusion of many dwellings, potentially around 300, and associated planting and other domestic modifications. This would have the effect of degrading the ONL of the wider valley. The existence of this extensive rural lifestyle zoning limits the ability of council to protect the landscape of the valley from inappropriate development and will result in significant impacts on the qualities and characteristics that make the landscape outstanding. I have identified two areas in which rural lifestyle zoning could be retained with little adverse effect on the landscape of the valley. In my opinion, the rural zoning over the rest of the valley would be more appropriate than rural lifestyle. I note that Mr. Barr has recommended that more land than I consider appropriate should remain rural lifestyle. Now this is not to say that Mr. Barr and I disagree. Mr. Barr and I had different information on which to base these evidence on, and different approaches to its consideration. Yesterday morning I went up to the valley and had a look at the areas that he had identified in his evidence, page 19 of it if you want to look, and identified which of those areas I thought could remain rural lifestyle as well. And having discussed this with him, I think we are agreed that one of the more southern ones that he has suggested could remain rural lifestyle, probably should not. And the very most northern one, if possible, should not either, but the more central areas could. So that's more than I originally included. Submission 325, moving to the Matukituki Valley now, requests that the ONL status of the floor of the Matukituki Valley be uplifted and the flats and downs of the submitter's land, the Matukituki Station, be identified as rural landscape classification. I've completed an analysis of the valley landscape from first principles as detailed in my evidence. And in my view, despite modifications brought about by farming, the entire valley is appropriately identified as outstanding natural landscape. I note that the outstanding natural landscape states that the balance of the flats and downs within the valley within the Aspiring and West Wanaka stations has not been challenged. I consider that the relief sought by the submitter should not be granted. Submission 1038 challenges the appropriate location of the ONL boundary adjacent to an upstream of the Albertown Bridge. Although principally addressed by Ms. Melsoff in her evidence, I simply wish to confirm that I consider the correct location of the boundary to be at the edge of the terrace escarpment, and that I understand that this is where Ms. Melsoff has located it in her rebuttal evidence. Submission 583, wishes to have the ONL status of the Fernburn Valley floor uplifted and replaced with rural landscape classification. They argue that this reflects the Environments Court decision in C73-2002, which was the first part, no it wasn't, so I beg your pardon, and that this classification, as it was included in Council's map, at Appendix 8B of the ODP should be reinstated. The Environment Court in its C79-2012 decision, which is the third part in the Bay decision, clearly states that they consider that the Council was in error to identify this area as visual amenity landscape on its ODP Appendix 8A map on the basis of their earlier discussion, or the Court's earlier discussion of the area. The court continued to explain why the Fernburn Flat should be considered part of the surrounding ONL. I accept that position and agree that the Fernburn Flats are too small on their own to be a landscape and are perceived to be part of the surrounding mountain landscape. Consequently, I consider that the relief requested should not be granted.
Ms. Dr. Reid, could I just ask you to pause there so I could ask Ms. Scott a question? The issue that Dr. Reid just canvassed, I thought that Glendu Bay had withdrawn that aspect of their submission. Is that not right? That the classification, I understood from their evidence, they now accept that the whole of their development lands are ONL. But can you clarify whether that recollection is correct? I don't want to trouble Dr. Reid canvassing the issue if it's no longer contentious.
I believe that's their position and their evidence. I have not seen formal withdrawal of the submission point, though.
Well, I think we'll take their evidence as a given. Thank you.
Submission 583 also requests the creation of a new Gendry station zone to encompass the entirety of the Gendry Bay station, which incorporates the area subject to the consented Park and State Golf Resort, which was consented by RMO 70044 or C79 and C79-2012. The proposed Gendry station zone is intended to facilitate the consented development as well as additional activities. In my evidence in chief, which was based on the GSD as proposed in the submission, I concluded that the relief requested should not be granted. The proposed Glendu Station zone has been amended through the evidence of Ms. Fluger and Mr. Ferguson on behalf of the submitter, and my rebuttal evidence addresses this amended version. I consider that most of the modifications to the proposed Glendu Station zone are positive. I remain opposed to the relief requested, however, for the following reasons. 8 home sites are sought in addition to the 42 consented. Only one of these home sites seems to differ in any way from the 8 which were declined consent in the original council hearing. The consented development includes specific footprints for buildings on the 42 home sites, with the requirement for vegetated roofs and a height limit of 3.5 metres above the defined RLs for each site. Building on home sites in the Gibson Station zone are proposed to be a controlled activity. The RLs are retained, but the future building designs are not specified beyond basic design controls, and the maximum building height, while low from the original submission, remains at 4 metres above RL. This could allow for much less subtle development, and consequently effects which are significantly more extensive than those allowed for by the consent. Controls on the planting of exotic vegetation have not been carried over from the consent into the proposed zone. Controls from the extensive covenants required by the original consent have not been carried over to the proposed zone. The proposed zone encompasses 2,483 hectares, all of which is ONL. The development area constitutes approximately 180 hectares. It remains my opinion that the landscape is best managed in accordance with the consent conditions and with the covenants required by the Environment Court, in addition to the requirements of Chapters 21 and 26 of the proposed district plan. I'm happy to answer any, I'll try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Reid. Commissioner Munro.
Dr. Reid, I'm going to try and speculate and go off script a little bit here, so my question will be totally dependent on the Chair's indulgence. But what I want to ask you, I intend to ask other landscape experts that I hear from too. A number of the submissions raised in one part or another come to address the question of how urban versus rural, or different categories of development, one's under the other, should interface and meet each other. To give you some background, I had a discussion with Mr. Falconer yesterday about one specific submission affecting Wanaka Town. And the topic of the discussion is how to approach when it is best to prefer a hard edge from A to B, or when the softer transitional tapering from A to D via B and C is the way to go. And what I'd be really interested in learning your thoughts on is how, as we're starting to approach the submissions, what kind of indicators you would look for to support the harder edge or the softer edge, as the case may be. Are there any general principles you could help me with there?
Well, possibly, but they're probably not landscape oriented.
Well, then you probably should leave it to other people then. But
well, my general position is that, particularly for urban areas, that a hard edge is preferable to a soft edge. And part of the reason for that is the non-landscape issue, that it seems that a soft edge is much harder to defend effectively. For example, Lake Hayes Estate had a soft edge once upon a time. The entire perimeter of it was zoned rural residential with a minimum lot size of 4,000 square metres, and almost all of it has been subdivided by resource consent down to low density equivalents. So that it's the defensibility of the boundary that's an issue. Yes, I mean, does that answer your question?
Look, I'll take everything I can get from the witnesses. So that actually is really helpful, and I don't see how your experience with the administration of these things from your perspective seems to me that's totally fair for you to say, but it is helpful, thanks. That's all for me, thanks.
Commissioner Hudson.
Thank you.
Commissioner McLeod.
Just for the record, as we're, this has been recorded, I think you did refer to this as the Gibston Special Zone. It's actually the Glendu B Special
Zone.
No,
Glendu.
Yeah.
Glendu Station Zone.
Yeah. Oh, I just thought I jumped across the hill there for a bit. You mentioned in your rebuttal that the covenant protection areas are not the same in similar protections to those provided in the consent over areas of the proposed zone. They do not, however, coincide with the areas upon which the covenants were to be placed.
Could you direct me to which?
It's in the rebuttal evidence on 3.2i. And I was just wondering.
Oh, I think that's my summary, yes.
And it was, I was just wondering if the covenant areas had, was that to do with the fact that they varied from the original to this one, and maybe that's what the chair's been.
Well, in fact,
arriving at.
What did I say?
Dr. Reed, I wonder if I should ask you, are you available to return to. To appear before us later in the week, briefly? Or is it now or never?
Well, it's a 3-hour drive each way to get here, so.
Not desirable. Well, I was going to say it would be a good idea to have this discussion when the plan that I've asked you for is hand, but if that's going to be too difficult, then carry on.
I'm just having difficulty finding the. Point at which I discussed.
It's at the top of page 4 of your rebuttal evidence. Yes.
Well,
I think the plan will show what the difference is.
There you go. That would answer that question then.
That's what I envisaged.
I figured that was.
What am I reading if I'm not reading? Sorry.
The discussion I've just had offline with Commissioner McLeod is that the point of my request for the plan would be to illustrate where those differences are.
Well,
but if you could summarise what the differences are that if, to your mind, then we can go forward with this question.
Well, as I understand their intention, the areas that they are proposing to protect by covenant are much more limited and would be from different covenants of which I don't think we have the text for. For example, they have a southern tributary and moraine slope landscape protection area, which isn't actually defined anywhere that I could find. It's defined on the structure plan, it's detailed on the structure plan, but there's no, I couldn't find any information that actually defined what its purpose was or how it was to be protected. And there's further the landscape conservation areas, which are in approximately I'm just trying to find the updated structure plan without success at the moment.
I wonder if the best one is attached to your rebuttal is appendix 1.
I'm just looking on your page. Yes. Also, the covenant protection area overlay is clearly very much more limited. Well, sorry, the farm and vegetation. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm confusing myself here. because the issue is that I don't think that they don't clearly indicate how the covenants that were required by the court would be translated over into the zone, and they don't actually define the areas that they would cover. And given that they proposed development in areas which the covenants required by the court would not allow for, then there must be some difference intended.
Here's the nub.
Beg your pardon?
There's the nub.
Perhaps if you could give us an example and go forward on that basis. Like I think I understand what you mean, but let's put, get it on the record.
Well, for example, there are the two or three houses that they want to enable, which are contrary to the consent. I'm sorry, this is level of detail in an area that I wasn't really anticipating. For example, Area E was to be covenanted against further development in perpetuity. But it did allow for some things. It allowed for subdivision. It was to allow for alterations, repairs, and extensions to the existing dwelling. It was to allow for the construction of a shed for storage of farming and landscaping equipment. The construction of a chapel and the erection of temporary buildings such as marquees, etc., for weddings. And this is the approximate area, or assumes in part at least, the area that is now intended for the little commercial village, including the tannery, abattoir, shops, those sorts of things.
Can I just clarify, that was E for Eric, not B for Basil?
That's right, E for Eric.
No, I think I'll actually wait till we. Yeah, that's fine, thanks.
Dr. Reed, I'll now probably put to you something that you haven't prepared for as well. A good start. Have you read Mr. Espy's evidence in relation to the O&L lines on the terraces of the Cooper property?
No, I haven't.
Mr. Espy takes your name in vain, pointing to an apparent inconsistency in the position you have adopted. And I wonder Council, if you could give Dr. Reed a copy of Mr. Westby's evidence, we'll just take a moment to read paragraphs 4.5 to 4.8, because I wanted to give you the opportunity to respond to that.
This relates to Glenn Dean, 4.5.
Glenn, it's the wrong one.
I got the wrong
thing. Yes. You want the rescue's evidence in support of the Cooper submission 400. And so this is the terrace opposite Rico's port. Got your head around it?
I think so, yes.
And so as I say, Mr. Espy is undertaking what I might call what a lawyer would call a collateral challenge in his Millsop's opinion by praying in an opinion you voiced in the relation to corporate estates, and indeed suggesting that you yourself, that position is inconsistent with the reports you've undertaken for this process. Now, that's all background, and my question to you is, are they inconsistent? If they're not inconsistent, can you explain why not? And just generally to give us a response to the implicit, if not explicit, criticism that Mr. Espy is making of you.
Okay. Well, it's, I think it's a very explicit criticism. and I think, you know, it is fair to say that, there's an inconsistency between my landscape, between the landscape lines report that I did for council and the earlier Coleridge assessment that I did. I would point out, though, that the Coleridge Estates land is on the south side of the river, and I identified in that hearing, in that case, that the ONL boundary or ONF boundary or whatever, whichever it was I thought at the time, was ran along the top of that southern terrace. So from that point of view, I'm not being inconsistent. I considered that the entire southern terrace space was part of the outstanding landscape of the river, or the outstanding feature of the river. I think that one of the problems that has arisen in regard to the categorisation of this landscape area has been my rather possibly dogged in the face of evidence to the contrary, that this part of the Clutha River should be considered to be a feature in its entirety, from the top of the terrace on one side of the river to the top of the terrace on the other side of the river. Ms. Stephen disagreed with me on that too. It's my opinion that it is correctly classified as an outstanding natural feature because it is such a striking feature. From approximately the Red Bridge at Luggett to the confluence, at least, of the, to the start of the Cooper Flats, really, that the canyon of the river is a striking feature. You don't even know that it's there until you're upon it, really. You can drive along the main highways around here and not even know that it's there. You can't see that there's a river. However, what that complicates then the classification of the features in the Cooper Flats. So it appears that the flats in the Cooper I'm considering them to be a landscape in their own right, where in actual fact what I consider to be the outstanding landscape in small without capitals is the entire Clutha River corridor and the terrace system of the confluence of the Cadrona, Clutha and Hawea rivers. So if Mr. Espy's position were taken to be correct, and that effectively the feature of the river is from the margin on one bank to the margin on the other bank, and that's it, then I would still consider that from the top of the terrace on the south to the top of the major terrace on the north was an outstanding natural landscape.
Thank you for that. So it's summarising to make sure, again, that I've got this clear in my mind, it's the difference between a feature and a landscape.
Yes.
You just give me a moment to write this all down. Now, in relation to Makarora, the interpolation you made to your summary, could I ask the council give you a copy of Mr. Barr's figure 2, which has all of the if you've already got it, that's
I've good. Got figure 1, page 19.
That could well be right, but I think it may be a copy of what I'm looking at. Oh, yes. That, yes, we can operate on figure 1. If you've got figure 1 in front of us,
yes.
Seven areas that Mr. Barr has recommended.
Yes.
And the ones that you, in your evidence in chief, supported on landscape grounds were the 1, 2, 3, 4th from the top, and the right-hand one of the two bottom ones.
Yes, that's right.
Now, the question for you is, which is the one in the centre that you're now comfortable with from a landscape perspective?
Well, I'm particularly comfortable with the second one up. This is so hard.
If I ask Council to find for you, Mr. Barr's figure 2 in his appendix, we can describe them because he's labelled them by area.
Right.
Rather than the top, bottom.
Yeah. Is that the rural section 42A?
Correct. I understand that in your evidence you were comfortable with the 16.71 hectare area and the 9.45 area.
Yes, comfortable is possibly not quite the right word. They're both areas that have been already been, that I was able to determine have already been subdivided to their maximum capacity already. I understand from Mr. Barr that the other areas that he's identified have been are areas where there has been some activity in terms of either subdivisional development of some sort over the last 17 years or so that I wasn't able to pick up from my access to the Lake Queenstown Lakes records through the public portal rather than the internal portal.
Yes, and suffice to say that was an issue I was going to discuss with him about the scope for further subdivision in those areas. Now, in terms of the additional area that you say that you have identified as being that you're not comfortable with, that you'd accept on landscape grounds, which one is it?
Well, I would accept the 22.96 hectare block, which is quite complex. Topographically and has a lot of mature trees and so on it. I think it's an old one of the station homesteads was there. And the 13.33 hectare area adjacent to the township zone, although my impression is that Mr. Barr's blue area actually overlaps part of the township zoning, but that could be.
So are you saying that you also support the 13.33 hectare area?
I don't think there are any landscape grounds to object to it staying rural lifestyle. Perhaps I'll put it that way. It's, or the 3.8 hectare area.
One of the things to give fair notice that I'll be asking is whether Mr. Barr is whether there are hazard grounds, which is not something that you of course can opine on. So I'll just get that down.
And I also think that the 15.11 hectare block at the northern end is marginal. There are a couple of houses there now, and they're pretty subtle and tucked up there behind a lot of large vegetation, but it's a big area. It's immediately adjacent to the national park. It's largely open to the highway.
And there are two 16 hectare lots that would produce a lot of rural lifestyle.
Potentially. It is immediately adjacent to Phipson's Creek, and I'm quite amazed that the houses were allowed to be built where they are.
Yes, suffice it to say, in our site visit, we took in the location of that creek. Well, that's interesting.
It brings down boulders the size of cars were quite regular, quite regularly.
Okay, thank you for that, Dr. Reed. Paragraph 3.3 of your rebuttal evidence, you're discussing the proposed extension of the golf course, the GE area at Glenview Bay, to straddle the Fernbury.
Yes.
And you're drawing attention here to the issue of buildings that would be able to be accompany that rezoning. Question for you is, would you be so concerned if it was just a golf course with no buildings?
Yes, I think so. I was very surprised when I saw that in their plan. I actually wonder if it's a mistake. They don't provide any text. They don't acknowledge that it's changed. I wonder if it was a drafting error, or I don't see what they stand to gain by extending the G area into there. But
I suspect it's a consequence of having moved the living, the lakeside area down off the terrace. They've chewed a chunk out of their golf course, and they're shifting it round.
Oh, I see. Possibly, yes.
That one, and maybe, of course, it's not evidence, we did rather get the impression in our site visit that the design of the golf course is a movable feast, which you would not discern from the consent conditions.
No.
But coming back, on the basis that if it were a golf course area, you would have the same concern with or without buildings?
Well, there are a number of buildings in that area already, but farm buildings. No, I possibly wouldn't. I think the golf course would not necessarily be problematic there. Kept John McRae's cattle out of the creek, apart from anything else.
And but presumably, if they had a hole that straddled the creek, you might be concerned. Well, would you be concerned about the loss of the trees currently straddling the creek?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. Well, there's willows and poplars, aren't they?
Yeah.
They definitely add some amenity and character to the area. I don't know that would there loss be a necessary consequence.
That might depend on the if they're treating the creek as a hazard.
Right.
That the players need to play over. You have, of course, the contamination of golf balls dropping in the creek. But that would be a function of the design.
Yes,
so I think
that's right.
Given that what they're proposing straddles the creek, I think we have to proceed on the assumption they might have holes that straddle the creek, or they might have holes entirely on one side and entirely on the other. And I suppose the question is, do you have a view as the acceptability on landscape grounds of either?
I really don't feel that I can comment.
Because there's not enough information as to what they're proposing.
Yes, that's right.
And following on in your rebuttal, paragraph 3.5, I was interested in the logic of the last sentence, that moving from a consent condition with a tight control over how it's designed to a zone that would be the subject of further consent process would be likely to produce different designs. And I suppose the question is, why is that? Why would it be likely?
Well, is that what I said? It's still likely that rather than 50 subtle, I didn't mean it was likely that there'd be definitely 50 different ones, but that simply each house site is on its own lot. There is the potential. Under the consent, although it's my understanding it was always intended that some of the dwellings would be in private ownership and some would be visitor accommodation, there was a consistent design palette, or consistent design. There are only two basic floor plans that are mirror images of each other, and the controls over the design of the building were absolute. Under the proposed zone, you have 50 dwellings on separate lots that can be constructed as a controlled activity subject only to design controls. There would be nothing to, there's no reason the developer might wish to sell all 50 lots off individually and leave them up to 50 different owners to apply for 50 totally different designs. There's no nothing in the proposed zone that would prevent that from happening or would suggest that the developer still wishes to construct the dwellings or anything past the fairly simple design controls on the proposed zone to suggest a common style or theme or palette for the construction of dwellings in the future.
Is it as simple as that if there are 50 owners, the likelihood that they'll all apply for the same thing is reasonably low?
Very low, I would say. Extraordinarily low.
Especially given what they'll pay for those sites.
Exactly.
Now, another couple of paragraphs further on, 3.7. Your last sentence. Even a slight increase in the level of visibility of the number of dwellings would have a significant effect. And I wanted to ask you about the would.
Yes.
You're very certain. Is it would or could?
No, I think it would. This is sort of the fundamental issue that I have, is that the consent was very finely crafted with extreme detail, and what the proposed plan allows for is an extra 50 centimetres of height without any 50 centimetres extra height over the 42 sites that were consented, which will must immediately make dwellings on them more visible than they if. I guess I am making the assumption that the RLs and the height limits were set at the optimum level for to ensure their lack of visibility or subtlety or whatever, however you want to describe it. Given that there are 10 centimetre variations in the RL levels, that's an extreme level of subtlety. So immediately giving another 50 centimetres is going to change that. Plus you have a change in the design controls at the same time.
Thank you for that. And the going to paragraph 4.2 of your rebuttal. This is just to get clear in my own mind, where you've said the development area is restricted to only 178 hectares.
Mm-hmm.
Does that include all the area of the trails up on the hill?
No. No, it doesn't include the trails. That basically is the RG, you know, the areas on the structure plan.
Okay, so the follow-up question would be, in terms of translating the key in fact all of the consent requirements, would it in fact be advisable if there was a zone that it included those land to make sure that or put another way, is it a flaw in the zone proposal that it doesn't?
Sorry, I don't understand.
and it may be that it's a planning issue that I should ask Mr. Barr this question, in which case he'll be thinking about it, no doubt. The concept that the applicant set out to achieve, apparently, is that the consent conditions are translated to the zone requirements. You've identified areas where that hasn't occurred, and therefore, in your view, that's a flaw in the proposal.
Right.
Multiple flaws. My question is, if the area of the subject of the zone doesn't include the trails, which were, of course, a key feature of the environmental compensation that got them over the line in a consent setting, is that a problem?
I have to say it's not something that I've put my mind to. I was more concerned about the revegetation and the non-development aspects of the covenants.
Right, well, maybe we should leave it there and then ask Mr. Barr to opine on that. Now, Now, and I have one last question, and it may be that you've answered it in among the material. The aspect of the Glendu Bay proposal that took my eye looking on some was the size of the proposed camp area over the road from the existing camping ground. Is that an issue to your mind in terms of the landscape effect of developing the landward side for camping purposes and to that extent? Or should I be reassured by your view that it's not an issue?
I don't think that it's an issue. It certainly is a very big area that they're proposing for the camping ground. I guess that when I've been thinking about it, my main concern has been how do you operate a camping ground with basically with a road right through the middle of it. I can see all sorts of problems with that rather than the landscape effect of it. The camping, yeah, because it is, I think it would read as not obviously not part of the same camping ground because the road slices it right through the middle, but it builds on what's already there.
And it would be perceived as part of the same.
Yes.
The image as you come sweep round the corner to the start of the camping ground on the right, it wouldn't be an issue if there was a.
No.
All right, I'll treat myself as being reassured. Thank you, Dr. Reed, for your evidence. Any final questions?
Dr. Reed, just asking you, is that on?
Yes.
A follow-up question from the Chair's one about Glendu Bay and the campground. Forgive me if I've overlooked it, but would your opinion be different if the new or proposed campground area had a large or a number of permanent buildings? I mean, the existing campground is largely full of buildings, but I would expect a larger campground could potentially have permanent facilities. So I'm not sure whether that's clear in the provisions.
I think that it allowed for the sorts of buildings you would expect to see in a camping ground, like ablution blocks and that sort of thing. Sorry, I'm not sure where in the provisions the Yes, it does allow for visitor accommodation. Restricted to farming, farm structures and visitor accommodation, limited to the establishment and operation of a camping ground. So it's a bit obtuse really as to what's meant by that. I guess I had imagined that meant maybe a couple of bunkhouses along with the usual cooking, etc. If it meant more than that, then it could be a matter of anxiety, but I'm not sure what the...
But just to be clear, your comment that the campground would be seen as an extension of existing,
yes,
and you were not unduly concerned about it, that had taken into account the presence of typical
yes.
facilities?
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Well, continuing that theme, the assumptions of the mother of future problems, I haven't looked in detail to see if there are detailed standards, but would it be advisable if there were standards to ensure that structures were, as you say, typical camp structures.
Yes, it would.
And not a four-storey hotel.
Yes, it would. Yes.
Standard Ministry of Works concrete ablution blocks.
Well, perhaps something a little more picturesque.
Yes, there are some very fetching ablution blocks at the Basin Reserve that have been subject to much comment. I understand exactly what you mean. Any more for any more? Thank you very much, Dr. Reed.
Thank you. The council's next witness is Ms. Helfer. Amended figure 6 was handed in today, and I will understand that you have that in front of you, that's
yes.
The attachment piece. And I also understand that Ms. Housop has a correction to make to her evidence. Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Housop. Before you start,
yes.
I asked the admin team if it was possible to project your evidence onto a screen, and they assured me that they could put it on that big TV behind you. So if as part of your evidence you want to expand on anything, in effect, point to things, because I will ask you to point to some things in your evidence, then we have that facility available. Well, I hope we do. Julia's in the group. In the process of seeing if the technology will work for us. Oh, we've got a very special palm tree. Let's get started.
First of all, I'd just like to make a correction to my evidence in chief at paragraph 8.23. It refers to figure 3 and it should refer to figure 4 rather than figure 3. Read my summary of evidence. I've been engaged by Queenstown Lakes District Council to provide evidence in relation to landscape matters regarding requests for rezoning and landscape boundary changes in the Upper Clwyd area of Queenstown Lakes District. The district includes some of the most spectacular landscapes in New Zealand. These landscapes are highly valued by both residents and visitors, and are vital to the economic value of tourism. The Upper Clwyd Basin has been formed by glacial and fluvial processes similar to those evident in the Hokitipu Basin, but it has a different character. It is more open and expansive, has a greater number of working farms, and a stronger pastoral character. In my opinion, the landscape characteristics and values of the Upper Clwyd that require protection and enhancement include the wild and remote character of the high mountain ranges, many of those are protected within the conservation estate, the openness, high natural character and visual coherence of the high country farming land, including the Pisa and Cripple ranges, the Mount Cardrona, Middle Peak, Roy's Peak range, the Grand View range east of Lake Hawea, and the ranges surrounding Lakes Hawea, Wanaka and the Maitukituki Valley. The legibility and natural character of the distinctive Roche Moutonnet within the basin, including Mount Iron, Mount Barker, Mount Brown, and those in the Maitukituki Valley. The natural character of the Upper Clutha's lakes and rivers and their margins, particularly those that are outstanding natural features or within outstanding natural landscapes. The legibility, openness, and either pastoral or indigenous vegetated character of the Upper Clutha Basin outwash plains, moraines, river terraces, outwash fans, and fluvial escarpments. And finally, the natural character and visual amenity of the approaches to and landscape setting of townships within the basin, it's Wanaka, Alberttown, Lake Hawea, Luggett, Cardrona, and Makarora, including the contrast between urban and rural or natural environments. I consider that the proposed district plan approach of mapping and confirming the location and boundaries of outstanding natural landscapes and features in the district is a sound one. On the whole, I concur with the Upper Clutha landscape classifications and boundaries that are contained within the notified plan. In response to submissions, I've recommended changes to the boundaries of the ONL or ONF in six locations. Some of these are relatively minor. The most substantial are the recommended exclusion of flatter rolling downlands in Maungaweta Valley from the Mount Maud, Mount Gold, Mount Burke ONL, and B, the exclusion of glacial meltwater channels and alluvial terraces between the Clutha River and Dublin Bay Road from the Clutha-Hawea Confluence Outstanding Natural Landscape. I've also recommended a change to the classification of the Clutha River Corridor and the Clutha-Hawea Confluence from Outstanding Natural Feature to Outstanding Natural Landscape. I consider that the outstanding landscape extends further than the margins of the Clutha River and the Lower Hawea River, which I identified as outstanding natural features. A number of submissions to the proposed district plan have sought rural lifestyle zoning within or immediately adjacent to outstanding natural landscapes or features. The majority of these zonings would, in my view, result in significant impacts on the qualities and characteristics that render these sensitive landscapes outstanding. I therefore oppose, from a landscape perspective, the rural lifestyle rezonings that are sought by Jeremy Bell Investments Limited and Lake Mackay Station at the northern end of the Pisa and Criffel Ranges. That's sought by Leslie and Jerry Burden on the western shores of Lake Hawea and by Alan B. Farms Limited at Mount Iron. I consider that these landscapes cannot accommodate change of the type or extent sought. In contrast, I consider that both Glendene Homestead and the Lake Hawea Holiday Park on the western shore of Lake Hawea have some potential to accommodate additional development without degrading the natural character and visual amenity of the outstanding natural landscape they're located in. However, in my view, the rezonings as sought, which are rural lifestyle and rural visitor respectively, would not ensure that an appropriate development was avoided in the outstanding natural landscape. In my view, either a sharp boundary between intensive urban form and working rural land, or a buffer of rural living activity with substantial retained open space, can be appropriate means of maintaining a legible urban boundary and protecting rural character and amenity. There are a number of rezoning requests that would not, in my opinion, maintain an appropriate distinction between urban and rural areas in the Upper Clutha, or adequately protect the rural areas of the basin from cumulative adverse landscape and visual effects. On this basis, I do not support the request by Street Developments Limited to extend township zoning south of Cemetery Road at Lake Hawea Township, or the request by Wakatipu Holdings Limited to rezone land north of Luggett Township to rural lifestyle. With respect to Wanaka Township, I consider that the following rezoning requests would not maintain an appropriate distinction between urban and rural areas or protect the quality and character of the urban fringe landscape. These are A, the extension of the urban growth boundary to Ruby Island Road, northwest of the township. B, the rural residential zoning south of Studham Road. And C, rural residential zoning along Riverbank Road to the west of the township. The Lake Wanaka terminal moraine ridge that encloses central Wanaka is a visually prominent and geologically significant feature that provides a natural landscape setting for and containment of the town. In my view, the large lot residential zoning of the moraine crest at Plantation, which is sought by Michael Beresford, and the low density residential zoning sought at Sticky Forest by Alistair Munro would both significantly degrade the integrity and naturalness of this important landscape feature. The terminal moraine is highly sensitive, in my opinion, to the cumulative adverse effects of additional residential development. There are a number of rezoning requests that I consider could be absorbed without significant degradation of the district's landscape character or visual amenity. I do not oppose rezoning of land between Lake Hawea Township and Cemetery Road to Township Zone, although I note that rezoning of existing rural residential areas could adversely affect the visual and rural amenities of current property owners. I also support low-density residential zoning of the Orchard Road Holdings Limited land on the eastern boundary of Wanaka Township, which in my view would form a logical and coherent edge to urban Wanaka. And I am in partial support of the low-density residential development sought by Michael Beresford adjacent to North Lake Special Zone. There are, however, a number of landscape issues that are not adequately addressed in relation to this area of proposed low-density residential zoning by Beresford. These include the visual and physical integrity of the terminal moraine ridge and the amenity of the adjoining parts of North Lake Special Zone. On the southwest fringes of Wanaka, I consider that the rural lifestyle zoning sought by Horsenden Farm and by the landowners south and west of Studham and Cardrona Valley Roads would ensure that a transitional rural living character was maintained on this edge of urban Wanaka. In my view, this area could accommodate a change to a rural lifestyle density, that is a 1 hectare minimum and a 2 hectare average lot size of rural living, without significant adverse effects on landscape character or visual amenity. I also do not oppose the extension of rural residential zoning sought by Lake Mackay Station on the edge of Luggett Township. I consider it could be absorbed without significantly degrading the character of either the township or the surrounding rural landscape. In response to the hearing panel's minute dated 11th May, I have attached the summary amended version of Figure 6 in my rebuttal evidence, which shows more of the land on the Central Otago District Council side of the district boundary and the O&L boundary of the Tesa Range within the district. In my understanding, the classification of landscapes within Central Otago District Council was undertaken in 2013 as part of Plan Change 5A for the district plan. At this time, I understand that consent had already been granted to subdivide land immediately east of the QLDC boundary into rural living rocks, which range in size from between about 4 to 10 hectares. And prior to this subdivision, rural living development had also been consented further to the south on the Queensbury Hills part of the Pisa Range. I wasn't involved in any way with Plan Change 5A and do not have any knowledge of the reasoning behind the location of the O&L boundary in the northeastern part of the Pisa Range. However, in my professional opinion, the extent of existing and consented rural living development on the lower slopes of the Pisa Range within Central Otago District would have precluded this land being part of the Pisa Range outstanding natural landscape. The existing and potential built form roads, earthworks and domestic activities significantly reduce the natural character of this part of the landscape. The extent of human modification means that, in my view, it could not be included as part of an O&L. I consider it appropriate that the boundary of the outstanding natural landscape within Queenstown Lakes District follows the district boundary to connect with the O&L within Central Otago District. As I've stated in my evidence in chief, I concur with the finding of the Environment Court that the land immediately east of the district boundary is part of the outstanding natural landscape. Sorry, that should be west. That's wrong. Despite the presence of consented residential development on the same landform within Central Otago District. Yes, and I have since had a look further. This map shows a little of the Central Otago District Council's O&L line, but further south within Central Otago District, the O&L actually comes down the Pisa Range further, more or less to meet the flats and the road. So the part within Central Otago District that's excluded from the Pisa Range O&L is that area of consented rural living development. And you can see, it's a little hard to see on this map that I've attached to my summary, but you can see the size of the subdivision boundaries just on the Central Otago District side. That's a subdivision called Pukerangi, and my understanding that was consented at least in 2009 at the time of the four developments Environment Court case.
I'm trying to get my east west lined up. Is this so? This is first facing due north.
Yes.
Flat. Is it Pukerangi?
Pukerangi is the name. It's, if you look it up, you'll find the information about the subdivision. Selling rocks there at the moment.
Yes, there's a sign on the state highway. Might take more and tea, adjournment, before we start. So adjourn until 25 to 12.
Thank you.